It's the takeaway for July 16th. I'm Tanzina Vega. The Trump administration is severely restricting access to asylum at the southern border.
The administration has been single-minded about trying to dismantle the U.S. asylum system.
What this means for people who are trying to seek asylum in this country. Also, you've all heard the president say this.
If you're not happy here, you can leave.
And this isn't the first time he's said racist things or that prominent women of color have been the target of vicious attacks. But is this a turning point?
No matter what the president says, this country belongs to you. And it belongs to everyone.
We're going to talk about it. Let's get going. It's been a big week for immigration news, and it's only Tuesday. The Trump administration has announced the dramatic change to U.S. asylum policy, essentially ending asylum protections for the vast majority of people arriving at our southern border. Effective today, migrants who cross through another country before reaching the U.S. cannot request asylum here. President Trump has implemented, or at least tried to implement, a number of drastic changes to the U.S. immigration system, but this is one of the most severe and wide-ranging yet. And this does not just affect Central American migrants. Thousands of people from South America, Cuba, Haiti, and Africa have made the arduous journey through Mexico to the United States border. So thousands upon thousands of people will be affected by this change. And it's expected to be challenged in court, of course, but the move does come on the heels of an attempt by the Trump administration to make a deal with the government of Guatemala to reach a safe third country agreement. Guatemala's highest court prevented President Jimmy Morales from signing the agreement. Here to help us make sense of it all, I'm joined by Jonathan Blitzer, staff writer at The New Yorker, and Philip Schrag, co-director of the Asylum Law Clinic at Georgetown Law and the author of Asylum Denied. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Philip, let's start with you. Give us some of the specifics here. The rule is trying to say no one is coming through any other country can come to the United States. How are people supposed to arrive? What is this law meant to do?
This is a very cynical attempt by the administration to pretend that we are sharing the burden with other countries, making people apply in other countries en route to the United States and wait to be denied before they try to come to the United States. But what we're really talking about is Guatemala, which is transited by Hondurans and Salvadorans, and Mexico, which is transited by those people and by Guatemalans, but neither of those countries has a functioning asylum system. In fact, so Guatemala has about 12 people working in its asylum office, only three of whom interview refugees. Mexico has a backlog of 50,000 asylum cases, and the United States has about 50,000 Salvadorans and Hondurans applying for asylum each year. So either we dump all those people into a non-functioning system in some other country, or, as the administration really hopes, they don't come at all.
And again, as we've said many times on the show, deterrence is really the goal here. Jonathan, who does this leave? Who can come to the U.S. to seek asylum if this new rule is in place?
Frankly, it's hard to imagine anyone. Just the basic mechanics of what seeking asylum at the U.S. southern border would mean would involve transiting through a third country. And the very premise of this regulatory change would be that anyone who did that wouldn't be able to apply. And there are kind of technical sort of carve outs for, you know, certain circumstances under which someone could presumably try to apply for asylum in the U.S. But those, as Philip says, this is an extremely cynical proposition, and those particular carve-outs do not seem at all serious.
Philip, the U.S. has a legal obligation to provide asylum to those fleeing their home country. Is this latest announcement in terms of international law even legal?
Well, there's both international law and domestic law consequences here. The most clear-cut legal situation is the domestic one. I think this is a patently illegal move by the administration under U.S. law. And that is because the American immigration law says that anybody who comes to the United States and is either at its border or in the country can apply for asylum. And Congress explicitly amended that law in 1996 to consider what happens when people come through other countries, through third countries. And they said that, yes, the United States can refuse asylum to those people under two conditions. One is if the country through which they came has a fair and full procedure for adjudicating asylum cases, which Mexico and Guatemala do not. And second, that we have an agreement, a safe third country agreement in effect with the transiting country. Well, the only country we have such an agreement with is Canada. And as you pointed out, Tanzina, the Guatemalan government has been enjoined from signing such an agreement with the United States by the Guatemalan Constitutional Court. So this is an end run by the administration around those very specific congressional mandates. The justification that the administration has given is that there is a provision of the law that says that the Attorney General can impose additional limitations on asylum consistent with the existing law. But these restrictions are not consistent with the existing law because Congress has dealt with this situation and has required a safe third country agreement before people can be turned away.
And we're going to get into a lot of the specifics about Mexico and Guatemala's role in this. But before that, Jonathan, I want to get a sense of what does this fit or how does this fit into the pattern of the Trump administration's actions on immigration and asylum so far?
I mean, the administration has been single-minded about trying to dismantle the U.S. asylum system. There are all sorts of things that the U.S. government could do at the southern border to help deal with this complex logistical problem of handling all of these asylum seekers at the southern border. A lot of the more sort of technical necessary fixes are being cast aside, and instead you're getting kind of a wholesale overhaul of the system. So the administration is obsessed by and large with two things. One is the idea of deterring asylum seekers from even making the trip in the first place. And so often these grand gestures, which don't pass any legal muster, are meant to send that kind of message. And at this point, it's well known that that kind of deterrent message never comes through in any meaningful way. People who are seeking asylum are desperately fleeing their home countries, and they're not making these kinds of calculations that are calibrated on messages sent by Washington in this precise way. The other thing the administration is obsessed with is the idea of trying to, quote unquote, close loopholes at the border. And it's true that there are complexities in the administration of asylum law in the U.S. at the southern border. But what the administration is trying to do is prevent people who are seeking asylum from being granted that initial sort of preliminary screening, and then from there being allowed to wait in the U.S. while their asylum claims are adjudicated. So what you're seeing is the administration kind of constantly trying to wage this war on two fronts. One, to just completely send this message of, you know, we are not a place of refuge. And the other, to try to create all of these barriers to block people from even entering the country, because asylum seekers, in the views of the administration, are not legitimate immigrants and don't have a legitimate claim to be here.
I'm talking with Jonathan Blitzer of The New Yorker and Philip Schrag of the Asylum Law Clinic at Georgetown Law about newly implemented asylum laws here in the United States. Jonathan, let's talk a little bit about, and Philip, we're going to get into now the specifics about the role that Mexico is playing and even Guatemala. Jonathan, Mexico's remain in the so-called remain in Mexico policy and U.S.'s talks with Mexico on immigration for months. Where does that stand? I mean, some people have even suggested that Mexico is part of the wall, if you will.
Yeah, I don't think it's wrong to formulate the situation that way. The challenge with Mexico has been that from day one, the Trump administration has wanted to strong arm the Mexican government into agreeing to some sort of safe third country deal. And two Mexican administrations, the previous one and the current one, have both pointedly refused to take up that prospect. What we started to see last month, however, was that under continued pressure from Trump and under the threat of tariffs on all Mexican goods, the Mexican government was willing to concede a little and at least allow the possibility that talks around remain in Mexico a safe third country agreement are on the table, which is a significant shift, and it is at odds with what the Mexican government is saying publicly. A similar thing took shape with the Remain in Mexico, or the Migration Protection Protocols, as they're also known. Same situation in the days and weeks leading up to the announcement of the Remain in Mexico policy. This is at the end of last year, December, January. The Mexican government didn't seem to suggest it was willing to agree to any such arrangement with the U.S., and then suddenly it was announced. And the Mexican government seemed to just go along with it. And now we have more than 15,000 people being sent back to northern Mexico as part of Remain in Mexico. So what you see is, you know, assertions by these regional governments that they're not going to take up these propositions put forward by the U.S. And then you start to see some backsliding. And that's a very worrisome dynamic. So what happened last month was the Trump administration said to the Mexican government, you've got 45 days to significantly improve your enforcement in Mexico in terms of turning away Central American migrants so they don't reach the U.S. border. And if we're not happy with what you've done, we're going to take back up these safe third country talks. So the Mexican government scrambles to show that it's getting tough on immigration enforcement. This has happened before. This happened in 2014 to some degree, albeit in a much more kind of carefully orchestrated and calibrated way with the Obama administration. But it's a common dynamic for the U.S. government to say to Mexico, okay, look, we need you to up enforcement because too many people are showing up at our southern border. The Mexican government has done that. It seemed to, in the last month, have made an actual impact on the number of people who are showing up at the U.S. border. But it's hard to imagine that the Trump administration at the end of this period is going to stop there and say, okay, we're satisfied. They're going to keep pressing. And we're actually right now just coming up on the end of that 45-day period. So it very much remains to be seen what the Mexican government is willing to agree to.
So Jonathan, let's talk a little bit about Guatemala here. Like, what incentive does the Guatemalan government or Guatemala have to agree with the United States in this sort of safe third country agreement?
No, it's a good question. And everyone is scratching their heads about this. There is no real incentive for the Guatemalan government to agree to such a sweeping plan as a safe third country agreement, or as we've now learned, a proposal that would even go farther than a safe third country agreement. The kind of bottom line, as I understand it, is you have an outgoing president in Jimmy Morales who's trying his very best to ingratiate himself with the U.S. government. It's not even clear exactly kind of what quid pro quo he has in mind here, but he's very much thinking self-interestedly. And then I also think an important part of this is Morales, and for that matter, other leaders in the region, do not fully understand the kind of intricacies of what some of these agreements consist of. And so I think a big element of all of this is quite frankly, confusion and misunderstanding about what it is exactly they're agreeing to. So I think it's easier also for the U.S. government to pressure these other regional partners into making concessions when these regional partners themselves are kind of spun around by the details and the intricacies and the particularities of what these arrangements would look like.
Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and Philip Schrag is professor and co-director of the Asylum Law Clinic at Georgetown Law and author of Asylum Denied. Thanks to you both.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
If you're not happy here, you can leave. That's what I said in a tweet, which I guess some people think is controversial. A lot of people love it, by the way. A lot of people love it.
This belongs to all of us. This belongs to you, and it belongs to me. And so the first note that I want to tell children across this country is that no matter what the president says, this country belongs to you.
I encourage the American people and all of us in this room and beyond to not take the bait. Sadly, this is not the first, nor will it be the last time we hear disgusting, bigoted language from the president.
He would love nothing more than to divide our country based on race, religion, gender, orientation, or immigration status. Because this is the only way he knows he can prevent the solidarity of us working together across all of our differences.
Our squad includes any person committed to building a more equitable and just world. We cannot. We will not be silenced.
As Martin Luther King said, all we say to America is, be true to what you say on paper.
You're complaining all the time. Very simply, you can leave. You can leave right now.
We don't leave the things that we love. And when we love this country, what that means is that we propose the solutions to fix it. And so we'll stay focused on our agenda. And we won't get caught slipping.
Over the past few days, President Trump has tweeted racist comments about four Democratic freshman congresswomen of color, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, and Rashida Tlaib. Some in the mainstream media have avoided calling Trump or his remarks racist, turning instead to euphemisms like racially charged. But this isn't the first time Trump has tweeted comments like this, or that the media has struggled with how to handle them. And I tweeted about it too. This isn't a new low. This is normal. Women of color, including me, who stand their ground and speak their minds, have always been considered problematic, uppity, dangerous, threatening. It's just become more visible to the rest of you all. But it's not enough to recognize this moment. The question is, what are we going to do about it? Well, Jemele Hill is with me to talk about all this. She's a reporter for The Atlantic. And also joining us is Aaron Haynes-Wack, the national writer on race and ethnicity for the Associated Press. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Yeah, thank you.
So ladies, the thing that struck me the most about this was how this was the moment, if you will, that the media, at least some of the media, started paying attention and started using the word racist. I'm a former race reporter. I know that this has been a battle. But why do you think this was the moment, Aaron?
Well, you know, I think that this is the moment because we've been dealing with President Trump and issues of race for 3 years now. And so, you know, much like his incorrect facts, if you will, you know, we have a substantial record of his views and rhetoric on race that have kind of forced this conversation and made newsrooms like mine really reckon with how we should handle reporting race and racism, both in the White House and in broader society.
Aaron, you've been on the forefront at the Associated Press, specifically with that word racist and how it should be used. Tell us a little bit about the work that you've done there.
Sure. And thank you for highlighting that. I really appreciate it because our newsroom did discuss this at length for our stylebook entry in this year's stylebook, which really discourages terms like racially charged and racially tinged, which are really kind of toothless euphemisms, which really don't get at what it is that we're trying to say and frankly don't accurately report the news, you know, and we are trying to leave an accurate record and tell the truth, you know, as journalists. And so what we hope to do with that stylebook entry is really to encourage journalists to consider why they aren't labeling something racist, right, which is not the same thing as calling someone a racist. I want to make that important point. And really, you know, to think about what it is that they do want to say. And you know, I think that this really speaks kind of more broadly to the reality that there are not, you know, there's not a lot of diversity in American newsrooms. And, you know, when you have journalists of color who are certainly more familiar with being on the receiving end of racism and therefore are probably more comfortable recognizing and calling out racism when that happens, you know, this is a conversation that we maybe are trying to really mainstream and bring people along in, frankly.
Jemele, what's your thought been on how different or not different the media has handled coverage of this incident with, quote unquote, the squad versus similar situations in the past?
Well, I think a lot of the hand-wringing, which even in this situation, which seems very blatant, still continues. It just goes to show how ill-equipped that I think mainstream media was in terms of covering a president, you know, like this. I mean, if we kind of unpack all of this and go all the way back to when Donald Trump was running as a presidential candidate, he was never treated very seriously or held to the same standard as other presidential candidates have been held to in terms of policies, the questions he was being asked, or for that matter, even diving deep into what, as we see now, is a very racist past. These issues hardly ever came up during the election. And that's a lot of it had to do with the fact that the mainstream media treated him like an entertainer as opposed to someone running for president. Fast forward to as he has progressively and consistently said racist things, there are a lot of newsrooms that didn't know how to handle it. And as Aaron pointed out, you know, very astutely, the embarrassing mark for the media is the reason they were unable and still a lot of are unable to call out this behavior and say what it is because their own newsrooms are, frankly, a very poor reflection of the issues that they're trying to cover in the communities that they're trying to cover. And for that matter, how this president's words and attitude and tone have impacted those communities of color. But at some point, I knew there would be a record scratch moment. And this appears to have been that record scratch moment where a lot of the media realized that if, as Aaron says, if they do want to provide an accurate historical reflection of what is happening now, then they're going to have to call this what it is. And Unfortunately, in 2019, we also, you know, live in a time where, unfortunately, to be thought of as a racist, to be called a racist, is somehow more attention grabbing and creates more conversation than the actual racism.
Jamel, I want to talk about the optics here, not of the president, but the conversation around race in the United States is often, and Aaron, you know this covering this as well, is often very black and white. What's interesting to me that stood out here was that these four freshman congresswomen represent different communities of color. How rare is that to see that type of a coalition of women of color and that level?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's definitely unique in American politics, and it speaks to what everyone has known for a long time, is that there's going to be a shift and a changing demographic in America. In fact, it's already happening. And we know that as these years go on, that they are a reflection of what America should look like and does currently look like. And so that is now being extended clearly to some very visible and high powered, you know, positions which they are in. And I think by seeing their solidarity, even if even though it preceded this, and unfortunately some people will be recognizing this for the first time, and it's under an unfortunate incident involving what is supposed to be the highest leadership in this country, I think it communicates the message that if they come for one of us, they're literally coming for all of us. And so I think it's a very powerful pact to present to the American people who maybe don't understand that the coalition, although there are very intricate and complicated problems that are different and unique in each, that there should be an underlying and overt level of unity, because we're all facing some of the same issues, problems, and certainly some of the same racism.
Just to echo what Jamel was saying, you know, I think that this is something that I've definitely seen reflected in my reporting since the election, where we know that a majority of communities of color did not support this president. And so, you know, in the wake of the election, you have seen a lot what's being reflected in Congress with the so-called squad. You're seeing that reflected in the country. You're seeing black and coalitions of black and brown, especially women, you know, in solidarity, you know, saying, just to Jamel's point, that, you know, what can affect one today can affect somebody else tomorrow. And I think the other important point to make on this is, you know, the comment, you know, the tweet from the president to you know, to these congresswomen, American congresswomen, to go back where they came from is certainly something that black and brown folks have heard before. I mean, I spent most of my day yesterday talking to Americans about having heard some variation of that, you know, throughout their lives. These were, you know, Muslims, Latinas, you know, or even just regular black folks who were born in this country, who were told to go back to Africa, and they were born here. So, you know, something like that is familiar to black and brown folks, and is something that has been kind of a galvanizing and unifying thing in the wake of these comments this week.
I want to talk a little bit about, too, the role of reporting versus opinion writing, if you will. And I think one of the things that led to this conversation, particularly the tweets, was, if we take a step back to, you know, feels like years ago, but just 2 weeks ago, there were a couple of opinion columns written by Maureen Dowd in the New York Times. One where she particularly says that this isn't about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's, quote, color, and that's the word that she uses there, that it's about her politics. Now, personally, I think it's fine to critique policies. That's what we all do, the three of us do as journalists. But where and how, what impact is do op-eds like that have on the discourse surrounding women of color in particular, particularly when we're talking about white women who are in these very elite positions?
Well, I mean, I think with this example, you kind of see what has always been a divisive issue within, say, the general in the general specter of feminism. There's, you know, feminism, which has largely been defined as white feminism. And then there are women of color who are facing different, unique and intricate problems. And it didn't just start with Maureen Dowd. I mean, to be honest, a lot of this was gaslit by Nancy Pelosi. Once she publicly told everybody that there was definitely a divide between established, Democrats and longtime Democrats like herself, who have become power players in the party, and this new wave of progressive thinking brought in by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and all the women who, and Ayanna Pressley, and the women who are under attack this week. I think that gave, that certainly inspired Donald Trump to seize on attacking them, because he saw the divide there. And it's been an uncomfortable problem and a tension that has been discussed certainly behind closed doors for years, where women of color do not feel welcome within this, sort of chase or this sort of movement, this overall women's, movement. And quite frankly, we have seen white women undermine, to me, what is the well-being of all women consistently, and especially that has been on display from the presidential election until now. It started before then, but let's just stick to the recent history. You have 53% of white women who voted for Donald Trump. You had an overwhelming number of white women who supported Roy Moore, and the list goes on. And it just seems like women of color are often left to put together the damage that a lot of white women have done to the overall well-being of women, period. Women of color have consistently, and especially Black women, have consistently been able to artfully vote for not only what will uplift their communities, but uplift all women. White women have not done the same. And a lot of them have betrayed their fellow women overall.
And I would just add to that, too, that this is really just, again, driving home the point that this is why diversity and representation matter in newsrooms, right? Whether we're talking on the opinion side or for folks like me who are doing that traditional unbiased, work. Because I think, here we are in July. It's the month that we're celebrating our country, a very diverse place that is founded on, a freedom of speech and ideas. And so, the more diverse voices that we have, it's not going to be, just the perspective of one columnist that we're hearing from. And we've got folks, like Jamel who are speaking truth to power over at The Atlantic. And I think that's it is really important to have all those voices. And thankfully, I think that we are beginning to see more of that, especially as newsrooms are beginning to recognize the value of having those diverse voices in a newsroom to really give perspectives, frankly, that we haven't always had to respond to issues of race.
Erin Haynes-Wack is the Associated Press's national writer on race and ethnicity, and Jamel Hill is staff writer for The Atlantic. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thank you so much. Have a great
day. Thank you.
Women of color, we want to hear your reactions to this. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the number. Give us a call. Thanks so much for talking with us. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.